Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 262, recorded Monday, August 22nd, 2016. Alan Cooper. Triangulation is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you fresh, high-quality ingredients to cook delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/triangulation and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/triangulation. And by Corning. Corning's incredibly durable Thunderbolt and USB 3.0 optical cables are longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. Go to corning.com/twit and save up to $130 on their superior Thunderbolt optical cables. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology and spend an hour talking about important and fun and interesting stuff, and I always look forward to it. We welcome you. It's a little, if you're watching, you're probably saying, what's going on here? It's a little different because we have just moved in as of last night to the new East Side Studios. There it is. And we are still, I mean, really, in the very early days here, we still have a lot of set decorating to do. There's a lot more work, a lot of technology has to be still moved over from the old brick house. So this is kind of a jerry-rigged version of Triangulation, but I think you're still going to enjoy it. And actually, this is somebody I've wanted to have on the show for ages and ages. He lives in Petaluma, or at least in the area. He's kind of legendary. The father of Visual Basic, that's what Mitch Waite called him, but even more importantly, a guru of interaction design, of UI. Alan Cooper is our guest. Great to see you, Alan. Welcome.
Leo, it's my pleasure to be here, and I've been waiting for you to invite me.
I know.
Thank you.
We had dinner 4 years ago, and you've been on my list, but you know, we were saving it for just this moment because we needed somebody friendly to try the new studio.
To deal with the chaos.
Yeah.
And as a software guy,
you understand.
That's my natural and
Yeah. I guess in some ways, TV design is a UI, an interactive design too, isn't it? Kind of.
It's all interactive.
Yeah.
It's
how people, I mean, it's a little more passive, but it's still, you have to think about what people are going to see, how they're going to absorb it, what, you know, what works, what doesn't work, stuff like that.
Well,
are you a visual guy?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a big part of it.
Well, but I'm not like design is not art.
It's not.
Not at all. In fact, if you're doing art, you're not doing design.
Right.
Design is problem solving.
What's the distinction? Problem solving.
Problem solving. I call it Alexandrian design. I'm the only person in the world who calls it that.
like the Library of Alexandria, Seven Wonders of the Ancient World, Alexandria?
It's Christopher Alexander. All the programmers out there will recognize that name. Christopher Alexander is a really interesting character. He's in failing health, and I was trying to get in touch with him. But he was a professor of architecture at University of California, Berkeley, for many, many years. And he is reviled by the architecture community. And the reason why he's reviled by the architecture community is because he's a thinker, and he scrapes down to bare metal. He goes back to first principles. He says, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
And he's written philosophically about design.
Yeah.
And most architects are building monuments.
I'm thinking he doesn't like Philippe Starck too much.
Not quite his thing.
Yeah.
So all of the programming community knows about patterns.
Yeah, design patterns.
They were invented by Christopher Alexander.
But not for software, but for
building architecture, which is one of the main reasons why building architects hate him, because he actually did some organized, systematic thinking about architecture
instead of
doing art.
I kind of like that.
So his first book, which I believe was his doctoral thesis, was published by Harvard University Press. And when I was a troubled 14-year-old youth in Kentfield, and I was in high school.
Marin County, just down the road a piece.
That's right. I was reading my way through the architecture section of the library. I encountered this slim little volume bound in black called Notes on the Synthesis of Form by Christopher Alexander, and boom, blew my mind because it was a philosophy of design.
And was it columns and lintels and pediments?
No. He says architecture is about synthesizing a context, synthesizing a form to satisfy a context. What you're doing is you're solving a problem, and the problem is given to you by the outside world. And the idea of what you're doing is you're reaching deep inside for your creative vision. You're not getting it. What you are as an architect is you're solving a problem that people in the real world have.
Is that the same as form follows function? Isn't that what Frank Lloyd Wright said? Who said that, I think?
So, Mies van der Rohe.
Mies van der Rohe, another and great architect. Yeah.
Form follows function. So I have amended that for the information age. Form follows function to hell.
All the way down the rabbit hole.
So if you're building a steam locomotive,
yeah,
you know, or a corn cob shucker, form follows function. But if you're building something out of bits, what the hell does your form follow your function for?
Yeah.
Is function follows the user. And in fact, if you're focusing on functions, you're missing the point. Is functions are what you had to deal with in the world of atoms and steam engines and mechanical mm-hmm. stuff. But
there's no pistons in software.
You don't travel around to do a lot of your interviews. You just snap your fingers and
the bits appear.
And somebody, that's exactly
the
it.
The bits appear.
So why do you want to follow your function? Your function caters to
they're not related?
Your image. Well, okay. We haven't entirely left the age of atoms.
Well,
behind.
In fact, everything that's been done up to now, and we're just starting to move away from it, has been in an effort to make people feel comfortable with digital technology by reflecting the real world we've grown up with. That's not the right way to go.
Well, we're moving away.
We're
from
moving
that
away
lot.
From skeuomorphism, the idea that you know red, you know, you have a green velvet.
That's a skeuomorphism is a cheap shot. It's saying it's like taking drugs. You know, they'll give you a boost, but you'll pay for it tomorrow.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about all that metaphoric
the brushed metal
design.
And the yep. velvet and the yeah.
It's
yeah.
what it does is it gives you the boost of familiarity.
Right. But even to the degree where a directory is a folder icon or
yeah, but we don't need folders and icons on computers. Yeah. What we need to know is that the stuff is out there. In fact,
right.
folders says you need to go out and find it. And software
it doesn't
can go beyond that.
It's there.
Can just bring it for you.
Right.
Yeah.
You don't need to dig through a folder. That's a really bad metaphor for what you're doing when you're looking for something on a hard drive.
That's the problem with metaphors, is they give you a cheap rush today to people who don't understand
yeah.
the technology, don't know how to use it.
But you pay that price because now we're digging through non-existent folders.
I'm hearing music.
Yeah.
Was it Lord and Vader?
It's the angels from heaven saying,
okay.
Alan.
Thank you.
Alan. this is fascinating. Yeah.
Well, as I say, if you see a $100 bill on the ground, you pick it up, but you don't quit your day job and say, I'm going to make a living picking up $100 bills. So if you find a metaphor that works, you use it. What the
right,
hell? But
right.
if you say metaphoric design is the right thing, what you end up doing is you end up doing what those General Magic guys did,
right.
which is they were these
they
were
had guys. A desktop, they had a little phone
they
on
had
the
a
desktop,
little
they had
street
a clock.
That you walked down and yeah. you walked into the AT&T yeah. building to get your connection. Yeah. It's like, this is overdoing it and for no particular advantage.
Well, it was to make people comfortable, though, with and maybe even understand.
People aren't comfortable with that. It's just a lot of damn overhead. And people don't use that today. They're perfectly comfortable not walking down the street.
It was clear that at some point Apple and Microsoft both said, we've got digital natives now. We can speak in a more digitally native
that
tongue.
Was the excuse they told. Okay, so what I said from the very beginning is you don't need that. People learn really quickly.
Yeah.
They don't need these
in
metaphors.
Fact, they'll learn faster than if you try to make it match the physical world, because it doesn't. So you're really giving them a guidepost that's wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're making false promises, because if you have a little telephone device, you know, or a printer device, then as an icon, then what you're doing is you're saying it's going to behave like that physical
right.
device. And all of a sudden, what that does is it gives you an anchor into the 20th century. And we don't want those anchors. We don't want them to behave right. like the mechanical right. device. We want it to be smarter. We want right. it to be more magical. And so metaphoric design is not a good thing. So Christopher Alexander is...
I have to read this now. I want to read
it. It's an amazing book. Yeah. It's a deeply flawed book, Notes on the Synthesis of Form. And he goes off into the weeds, and he starts doing some of the preliminary thinking that eventually became his work on patterns. But what you'll find is if you
can get it in PDF, you don't even have to buy the book anymore.
Oh, amazing. Look at the writings of some of the really significant designers of the last, 30, 40 years, you'll find that all of them credit this work as an important contribution to their thinking.
Including software designers.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, the thing is that the architecture community just dumped on Alexander for this work. But the software community went, this guy is talking to me.
Patterns.
But what's interesting about it is I've had long discussions with Christopher Alexander. It's been years. But he doesn't get software. And so all these people that love him, he still thinks in terms of buildings.
Here's another one, a pattern language, towns, buildings, constructions.
This is the work that most software developers are familiar with.
So Kent Beck and people like that said, oh, well, we could apply this to software.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I don't know if it was Beck. There was the patterns group.
It was a whole thing.
And it's a thing. But patterns are an incredibly powerful tool that have seen an enormous benefit and blossoming in the world of software design and interaction design.
It's based on
Alexander's work.
I also want to talk about BASIC, Visual Basic, and your role in that. He said, please, if you're going to call me the father of Visual Basic, put it in quotes. Put it in quotes. So we did. We put it in quotes. And then I had to say, who's the mother of Visual Basic? If you're the father?
The mother's Bill Gates.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I want to talk about that. That must have been... Did you work at Microsoft?
Can I drink whiskey on camera?
You can drink anything you want. Is that whiskey? That's not whiskey.
No, it's water, actually.
It's better to pretend it's whiskey. I remember Jackie Gleason. We're old-timers. We can talk this way now.
That's right.
Jackie Gleason. Right. At the beginning of every show, he'd drink a teacup. And he'd go, to pretend, of course, that it's booze. Probably was tea.
Probably was booze, actually.
Knowing Jackie Gleason, it was definitely booze. Our show today, Alan Cooper is our guest. We'll talk more in a second. Our show today is brought to you by Blue Apron. Love the Blue Apron. You know, this is design patterns for cooking. Blue Apron's mission statement is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone while supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Now, the problem, at least as I see it, when you want to cook a great meal, is you have to spend a lot of time thinking about it. You have to plan the meal. You have to go put a list together, go shopping, get all the ingredients, bring it home. Blue Apron eliminates that whole process. So when you get to the end of the day, you're tired, you don't want to go shopping, you get home, your Blue Apron box is on your doorstep. Now you're ready in half an hour, 45 minutes, to have an amazing meal that you cooked yourself from the freshest ingredients. The house smells fabulous. Your kids are clamoring, what is that? I want to try it. You're going to love it. And you'll be cooking recipes with ingredients like those purple things, though. Those are fairy tale eggplants. I never even knew about them until I met Blue Apron. Blue Apron allows you, by the way, this saves you money. It doesn't cost you money. You might think, oh, a service like that, they're going to send me all the ingredients to make a great meal. And by the way, exactly the right proportion. It is kind of like design patterns because, if you need 4 asparagus spears, you get 4 asparagus spears. You don't get 5. You get exactly what you need. There's no wastage. And it costs less than the grocery stores are 60% more expensive because they're brick and mortar. They have to have clerk and all this stuff. Blue Apron is sending you the ingredients. And by the way, it's the stuff you would buy at local farms, 150 local farms, fisheries, ranchers. The seafood is sourced sustainably. The chickens are like Alan Cooper's free range. The pork is raised naturally. We'll get some chicken stories out of Alan in a second. The farming practices are regenerative. So you're getting really great stuff from local farms. And it's never frozen. Nothing's frozen. It's all just it's the refrigerated box. It's great. It's cool when you get it. You open it up. You can arrange exactly what meals. In fact, go to look at the menu. Each week there's a new menu. You'll never get the same recipe twice, which is awesome. Porchetta-style sandwiches with baby kale pesto and marinated cucumber salad. chicken and fresh basil fettuccine with creamy tomato sauce, seared salmon, and sauce grebiche. I don't know what that is, but it sounds good with mashed potatoes, summer beans, and cherry tomatoes. That's the couple plan. They have a family plan, too, with kid-friendly ingredients, crispy chicken tenders, and roasted potatoes. The only problem is you make these roasted chicken tenders for your kids, and they're never going to be satisfied with McDonald's again. They're going to go, wow, make those again. Pan-seared cod and pickled grapes, lamb and beef feta burgers with Romano bean, eggplant, and summer pepper salad. So you pick the items you want. You pick the day of delivery. They come to you in the box. You open it up. You make the meal. You have a beautiful recipe card. They have videos online. They really walk you through it. You don't have to be a cook. You will be a cook by the end of this, though. Research shows Blue Apron families cook together 3 times more often. There's something special about a family that's cooking together. That is, I think, something we lost a little bit with all this fast food and easy restaurants. Don't go to the Olive Garden tonight. Cook. Blue Apron. Here's the deal. 3 meals free with free shipping. Go to blueapron.com/twit. Sweet pepper, zucchini, and corn stir fry with soba noodles and ginger cashews. Late summer fregola sarda pasta with Romano beans, ricotta, and crispy capers. You'll feel like a Tony Soprano when you eat that. That is awesome. blueapron.com/twit. Your first 3 meals are free. Just try it. We love it. When Blue Apron Day is a special day in the house. Our guest today, we thank Blue Apron, by the way, for their support of triangulation. Our guest today is an old friend, Alan Cooper. He is dubbed the father of Visual Basic, but as you can see, he's a lot more. He's a great raconteur. Your story of the chicken getting glued to the floor still makes the rounds in our family. I will never forget.
One of my neighbor's chickens would come over to our construction site, she came over, and every day, like clockwork, she walked through the dry creek bed and up, and it was quite a ways.
Chickens got habits, don't they?
She'd come and she'd go into the rear corner of this huge barn that that we were rebuilding, and she would lay a beautiful. There was a sheet of plywood leaning up in the corner that one of the builders had left. So there was this little coop back there, and she went in the extreme corner and laid one big beautiful brown egg every single day,
like manna from heaven.
It was fabulous, and we called her Renegado, and then somebody pointed out that it should be Renegada because she wasn't laying for my neighbor who had a commercial egg operation.
Oh, wow.
And so she was cheating. She came over and gave me her egg as well. She should.
That was so sweet.
It was wonderful. And then one day they painted the floor with this special industrial quality floor paint.
Oh, no.
And nobody thought about Renegada. And we came in the next morning and there she was glued to the floor.
Oh, no.
And
poor Renegada. Yeah,
it was, and they finally extracted her, but at the cost of all of her hindmost feathers.
Pin feathers.
She looked like a Foster Farms bird. She looked good from the top, but you flip her over, it was not pretty, let me tell you.
Oh, Lord.
And the shock was a lot, so that was kind of the end of the eggs for a while.
Well, thank you for, you brought me some eggs from your own chickens.
They're right here.
Oh, nice of you. But this is one, the best part about living in Petaluma. Monkey Ranch, is that your ranch?
That's Monkey Ranch. Monkey Ranch.
Wow.
That's where the magic happens.
Look at, those are beautiful. That's the first time anybody's ever brought me eggs on this show. Thank you, Alan.
Maybe the last time.
No, I love them. No, that's the best part about chicken.
Now, these eggs, they're not washed.
Okay.
And they're not refrigerated.
No, so.
So what you do is just gently wash them in lukewarm water just before you cook them, but don't refrigerate them. Leave them on your countertop. They're good for 3 to 4 weeks.
Any Renegada eggs in here?
I call them the Blessed Sisters of the Happy Breakfast.
That's nice.
Yeah, so.
Well, thank you. Are they Rhode Island Reds? What are they?
There's actually 5 of my birds are Rhode Island Reds. Mm-hmm. And there's a mixed bunch of heirloom breeds. There's some Barred Rocks and some Speckled Sussex and Australorps and Buff Orpingtons.
Oh, I love the Buff Orpington. I love the name anyway.
And,
can you tell and look at them and say, oh, that's a Buff Orpington?
Yeah, well, they're all different colors.
They look different.
Yeah.
And the egg colors are different too, right?
Well, I have one bird, a blue Andalusian, that lays white eggs, and she lays every couple days. So that's yesterday's eggs, and she didn't lay, so sorry. Otherwise, you get a white egg in there.
Our neighbors have blue eggs. I don't know where those come from.
Yeah, there's blue and green and speckled, all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
But that's not what we're here to talk about, although I could talk about chickens all day, frankly. Tell me about Visual Basic. So were you working at Microsoft? How did that happen?
No, I have never worked at Microsoft. I've never worked for Bill Gates. I was an independent contractor.
My own whiskey.
That's the vodka.
That's good. How did you get involved with this?
Okay, so, when I was born... No,
let's not start there. No, you know what? Let's start there.
I spent the 80s inventing software, creating prototypes, and selling it to publishers. Back in the 80s, Microsoft was a big player, but they certainly weren't dominant.
They weren't like they are now.
No.
But actually, I want to go back farther. Let's go back before then. What was your first computer?
My first computer was an IBM 370 135.
the tapes that go...
Yes.
Mainframe.
I was a pot-smoking hippie from Marin County.
Yeah.
And I was a high school dropout and a rebel.
Really?
And I said, screw you to the world and went off on my own. And the world told me, they said, Alan, if you don't, you know, toe the line and do what we tell you, you're going to be a ditch digging failure the rest of your life. And everybody, literally everybody, told me that as a teenager. And so I said, okay, I get it.
I can live with that.
Ditch digging failure. But I'm not going to put up with that crap you guys are handing me in high school, you know.
I don't care if that's what it takes.
And I spent a few years out in the real world, kind of going, I did psychedelic light shows for rock and roll bands and worked as a barista in the first Fern Bar.
This was the 60s.
In the 60s, that's right. And
everybody had a checkered past. If you were lucky enough to live in the 60s.
Yeah, we used to hire people. We would look for what we called the suspicious two-year gap on the resume.
Yeah, that's good.
That's right.
Now we know. We know what you were doing.
Yeah. And so...
1967 to 69, I don't remember.
I did the sort of obligatory hippie backpacking trip to Europe. Mm-hmm. You know,
Steve Jobs went to India.
Yeah, that's right. And so I had a buddy who lived in Zurich, and of all places. And one day I was walking down the street in Zurich. I had to hide my long hair because I could literally stop traffic in Zurich if I pulled my hair out from my jacket.
In those days, it was, yeah.
And I saw a computer in the basement of a bank. And it was a big IBM 360 with all those flashing red lights and the switches and stuff. And I said, I am going to learn the purpose of those lights and switches.
Really? That's so strange.
And
I mean, what a different path that is.
Yeah. There's just something
drew you to it.
Something drew me to it. And I started to walk into the bank and the security guards.
No.
So I went home.
Must see computer.
And I enrolled at the College of Marin, the local community college, and they had an IBM 370 there.
Wow.
And I took...
You found your calling.
I took Introduction to Business Data Processing. Was the
Fortran,
first class
probably,
I took.
Right?
Well, it was actually
COBOL.
It wasn't even programming. It was the mandatory first class at the time, and they taught me about unit record devices, which were card handling devices, card sorters and card punches. And so all my first programs I wrote were COBOL punched in cards.
Wow.
But that was the only class I took. I took every class that College of Marin offered in programming. I challenged them all, just took the exam.
You didn't take the class, you just took the exam. In those days, what did you read to learn this?
I just started coding.
You just started.
I got a job. I got a work study job working in the computer room as a computer operator.
So you had to have access.
No, not timeshare. No, this is a giant batch programming.
You're
and
there.
The IBM 370 ran the Marin Community College District's enrollment and registration and all that
stuff. Tell me about this. So you have a machine that punches the holes in the punch card?
Yeah, it's like a giant typewriter, except it has a deck of cards up here, blank cards, and it's all this monkey motion, form followed function back then. And it would take a card down, and as you start punching, the card would go chunka, 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 chunka across, and you'd hit you know, essentially carriage return, and it would slide over and go into another stacker. Another card would come down.
Now, a chunk, you're screwed, right? Yeah. There's no backspace.
Yeah, no backspace because it's punching holes.
So do you know at the time that you've done a typo, or how do you know what
sometimes,
you're typing?
Sometimes.
What are you typing? Words?
Yeah, yeah. Identification division. It's like, yeah, it was primitive.
So this was a record in a database on the card, or it was a line of code?
No, it's a line of code.
It's a line of code.
Line of code. So the first program you write is what they called an 8080 list. Every student back then wrote an 8080 list program because there were 80 columns to a Hollow Earth card.
Yep.
And an 8080 list would read in a data deck and print it to the printer. And so
So it's a simple program. It's something like get a card, read it, print
it. It's as simple as you want it to be. So I started writing a bigger program and then a bigger program, and then I started writing bigger programs.
Self-taught. Was there another guy, long-haired guy next to you going, hey, no, don't do that, Alan.
There were some teachers there who I really annoyed the hell out of. And I go, will you help me find my bug? You know, oh, my God.
That's a stack of cards, 800 cards.
They give you a... you get a core dump, and mm-hmm. so you have to read it in hexadecimal.
This is all the memory. This is what the memory has.
Yeah, and
you've got to figure out where your code is, what it's doing, where it went wrong.
So there was a time in the early 70s when I knew my hexadecimal timetables in my head.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank God I've forgotten that.
Oh, it's in there somewhere. It's in there somewhere.
But
wow.
Yeah, it was.
It's such a hardship. So, and I think it's, I wanted to walk through this because I think that a lot of people watching go, well, no, you just type in the screen and it's all easy. And no, this is was a lot of work. Who was it we were talking to? Was it Mitch Waite about flipping switches?
Yeah.
And getting very good at flipping those switches to load the bootloader.
Mitchell knows. And Mitchell went to the College of Marin also, by the way. And he worked on the IBM 1130 that they had in the science building, which was a very different computer because I was on the business side learning COBOL. But they were both equally primitive. The computer that I had was state-of-the-art. It was actually a very modern computer that the college owned. It had 144K of main memory.
144 kilobytes of main memory.
Yeah. So that's
not
six zeros fewer bytes of storage than your phone that's in your pocket has.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's not, you couldn't do anything in 144K.
They ran the whole school.
Yeah. It's mind boggling.
I know.
How much storage? How much disk storage? Or was it tapes?
They had, no, actually.
Did they have a Winchester?
This was before Winchesters were invented. It was very much state of the art. The College of Marin struck a deal with IBM, and we were a beta site for this IBM 370 135. So it was a brand new model, and we had disks. And the disks were these huge things. They were the size of a giant commercial refrigerator. And you'd go up to them, you'd push a button, and this drawer would slide up, and then the lid would lift up. We called them the automatic toilets. And
they were magnetic.
And inside it were 10 platters that were 17 inches in diameter, and you'd put a cake cover on it, and you'd twist the cake cover, and
you'd pull it out.
And you'd put another thing in.
Holy
and they
cow.
Held storage of a capacity beyond your wildest imaginings in 1973, 100 megabytes.
And how many? For 9, 8 platters?
Yeah, I think it was 10 or something like that. But this was before the Winchester. So there's the Winchester sealed the drives,
right.
the read-write heads
inside. You still have a big pack, but it's...
Yeah, but the heads were independent. So the whole computer had to be in a refrigerated clean room.
Holy cow.
With filtered refrigerated air, and you had to have a key to get in. I was one of the guys who had a key. So my job was being inside and accepting decks of cards from the students through the little window and running them through the computer.
You clearly showed real aptitude right away. I mean, they must have said, well, this guy really is good at this. Right? You got the keys to the kingdom.
I was making 3 1/4 an hour.
I'm not saying it's a great job, but they've trusted you, and you must have known what you had an aptitude for it, I think.
Although I did crash one of their disk drives once, but
pulling it out a little too soon?
No, it was
you have to let the spinning go down, right?
I forget what I did, but it was actually a soft thing is that, and they ended up recovering it, but I stepped into a dispute between two of the the higher ups who were fighting over data security.
Yeah.
And I walked into a trap that this one guy was saying, we got to plug that hole. And the other guy saying, no, we don't need to plug the hole. And I stepped into it and proved this guy's point.
Everybody who's anybody in technology has done that at least once, right? I mean, that's important too, part of the important coming of age.
Yeah. But there's the story of the guy who, and it's probably apocryphal, but the story of the computer operator who is the lowest of the low on the totem pole is he dropped one of those cake covers with the 10 platters in it and bent one of the platters and put it in the disk drive, and that didn't work. So he took it out and put it in the next disk drive, and that didn't work. So he put it in the next disk drive and basically trashed $1 million.
That was the later with the zip drive, the click of death. That was how people were destroying zip drives. Was they'd get a bad disk and they'd try it in other zip drives, and it would slowly ruin all of the zip drives, which would then ruin all the disks, which would then ruin the rest of the zip drives. So when did you get to modern computing? Because that is. That's prehistory there.
Well, I started a software company. I mean, I had a job. I left the school and got a job, and I would sit around and plot revolution with a friend of mine.
Did you have to cut your hair and wear a white short sleeve shirt and a little skinny black?
Oh, that's a whole other story. But no, I eventually cut my hair and sort of normalized. But so I started one of the very first software companies called Structured Systems Group in Oakland in 1976, the same year that Bill Gates started his first company. Wow. And you know, Gates was the language guy, and
right.
Gary Kilgore was the operating system guy, and Structured
VR
Systems
DOS.
Group, we were the business applications guy.
Interesting.
So Freiberger and Swain in Fire in the Valley called say that my company did the first serious business software for microcomputers.
No kidding.
That's what we did in...
And what microcomputer was that for?
It was for CPM systems.
Okay. So S100 bus.
S100 bus, yeah.
Sols, and I remember the Fortune computer. That was a business, early S100
all
business
those,
computer.
All those. Yep. All that stuff that ran CPM. And
North Star.
I finally left to... I was fighting with my business partner, and we went our separate ways.
Those programs were written in what?
They were written in BASIC. They were written in Gordon Eubanks's C BASIC,
okay,
which we were the first dealers for back in the day. I helped Gordon write that, actually.
Yeah. C BASIC, yeah.
And as I was saying earlier, I when I was trying to figure out what computer to buy, the first computer I actually owned, I went to visit Mitch Waite at his houseboat in Larkspur.
Yeah.
And he at the time was out ahead of everybody, and he was doing some documentation work because he was a writer. He was doing documentation work for the IMSI company. So he had this big IMSI computer with its sexy red and blue switches and red LEDs on the cover. And I'm looking at this and drooling, going, that's the computer. These guys are going to own the universe. IMSI, that's a name to conjure with. Remember IMSI, okay? And then, but he goes, no, this is over here. This is the computer. You have to see it. He has a stack of TTL cookbooks, these giant books.
I remember those.
Doing transistor logic.
Yeah.
Sitting on the floor and sitting on top of this stack of books was a naked printed circuit board with little clip test leads to a Ball Brothers monitor. And we played Breakout on it, which was a forerunner of Pong, and he goes, these guys are going to be great. And
he knew.
A company called Apple. It was an Apple One.
He knew.
And I looked at it, I go, Mitch, that's the stupidest thing I've ever seen.
By the way, we saw that Apple One a month ago.
He brought it in here. Yeah. I watched that show.
Yeah.
It was fabulous.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mitch, that's what's really astonishing, is that he still has the Apple One and it still works.
Well, it was a lot of work to get it working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, So the first IMSI that I owned, I sold to an accountant, because what we did is our first product was General Ledger accounting software. And
was it like 8-inch floppies?
8-inch floppies, yes it was.
So you hear the head hits and it goes clonk.
Yes. You have to sit control C, otherwise you're just right over this. Oh, man. Where was I going?
Oh, so you sold your IMSI.
So I sold it to this guy, and he came back to me 15 years later and said, I was one of the guys who invented the Y2K bug.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I invented the white.
Because you wanted to save two lousy bites.
Two bites were worth it in 1978.
When you have 141K of memory, two bites.
They were worth it, believe me. And it was a good trade-off. And we never expected our software would last until the next millennium.
That's right.
Cray cray. So anyway, that's when all my first company software all died on December 31st, 1999.
Really?
And this guy said, well, you want your computer back? He says, it's just a boat anchor in my office. So I have the computer in my office, and I threw away the disk drives because it's too complicated. But what I have can do, and if you look at my
YouTube channel, you can see a video of this.
Actually hand code in from switches on the front panel code, and you can get what I call low res video output. It's 1x8.
Is this it? MVI 1319 programming.
That's my the computer inside. Right there.
See, I love that front panel. Isn't that beautiful? And that's your company's name, Structured Systems Group. Wow.
And you can see how I was beguiled by that.
I can't see it, but I.
That to I'll me grant is a you. Thing of beauty.
And this is what you that's had to know. And by the way, on the right, that's the assembly language.
It's machine code.
Yeah.
It's not assembly. Well,
on the right is assembler, right?
Right, because I programmed in assembly. But then I had to translate it
into
actual
ones
bits
and zeros.
And then actually code in the bits. You don't actually see me coding in the bits here because I've already done it. But now I'm talking about the low-res video output there. That's the line of 1x8. That's and then I reset the program counter and fired up.
You threw away the disk drives because this was too much work? Thought this was a better way? I can see when you look at it, it is beautiful. You can admire what's going on.
So see,
on there.
Now it's counting up in binary.
Oh, yeah. Look at that.
That's about all I'm
that's
willing
about
to
it, right
go
there.
Down. Zero and one level beyond that, you know, no.
But that's the program running right there. The program
that is the program running.
That's it. Wow, isn't that hysterical? Wow.
And the bulk of the program are wait loops. So
what was your this IMSI? I guess is a personal computer, but really it wasn't until Apple and Atari and Commodore these. Smaller, full-featured computers that I really consider them personal computers, you know, desktop computers.
Well, there was no this is somebody else.
Yeah.
The notion of a personal computer took a long time to come. And Steve Jobs had that vision of the personal computer, but it didn't really come true until digital media. I mean, Jobs had, 2% of the market share,
right.
Relentlessly saying, I'm a personal computer. And the
when you say digital media, you mean floppy disks? You mean?
Digital media, I mean photography going digital, music going digital, and video going digital, and communications going digital.
Yeah, it's all about speeds and feeds, bits and bytes, until you have content.
Right.
And once your content is, and you could play with it, and you could create it, and you can move it around, and you can email it, then the revolution begins.
And that was when the world dropped Microsoft like a hot potato and shifted their attention to Apple.
Was that Microsoft's error, is not perceiving that shift?
Well, it's not an error. They dominated the 90s.
Right.
Because the 90s was the world of the workstation.
Of numbers.
And they had cheaper, more powerful, more portable workstations. But their vision was a computer on every desk. And Jobs had a computer for the rest of us. He didn't have the vision of a business computer. Bill Gates never recovered from that vision.
Right.
That's as we were talking earlier about the founder's DNA, the founder's vision, forever imprints on the company. And Gates was building business software, as I was in my first company.
Right.
And I have to say that it's hard sometimes to leave that behind.
Sure. Well, you do what you do. You do what you love. And although it's interesting that even after the founder leaves, the company maintains its kind of forward momentum in that area.
It does.
Yeah. They're trying. They've tried to very much become more like Apple, more like a home computer company.
Yeah, well, I hope they bring along a lunch.
There's your advice from Alan Cooper. Bring lunch. Alan Cooper is our guest. He is the father of Visual Basic. We're going to now get to the story in a moment of writing Visual Basic.
So at the end of the after I sold my company, I went out and I started inventing software, and and building prototypes and selling them to publishers. And I
selling them to companies that would sell it to end users, you mean?
Yeah. Or, yeah. So
what were your programs? What kinds of?
So I wrote one of the very first critical path project management programs called Super Project. Mm-hmm. And I sold it to Computer Associates.
Yeah, they did Super Calc and they had the whole Super Project line.
Yeah,
yeah.
And
that wasn't in BASIC.
No, that was written in C.
C. By now you're doing C.
Yeah. I don't like BASIC. Yeah. I'm not a big fan of BASIC.
No.
And
who is?
Bill Gates. Bill Gates loves BASIC. He's the man who invented Peek and Poke.
Right.
Peek and Poke are a travesty of language design. I just want to say that.
Almost here as bad now. As GoSub and GoTo.
Oh my God.
Don't get me started.
That's just wrong.
Just combine a Peek and a GoTo and you've got it. You've got magic, my friend.
It's so when Windows came out, I was not interested. And friends of mine who knew what I was working on said, Cooper, you got to pay attention to this.
But you made the transition to DOS from CPM.
Yeah? Oh,
yeah. Yeah. But it was Windows. You didn't like the GUI?
No, I was writing my own GUI.
Interesting.
And people, you know.
So SuperCalc had a GUI in effect. I mean, it was a DOS program, but you had a UI.
Yeah.
And you know, you had menus. You had a screen that people could interact with.
He can poke the horror. You got it. Bill Gates went to Xerox PARC and saw the demo of the Algo.
Yes, very famously. Yeah.
Steve Jobs did. Yeah. I did too.
Yeah.
Okay. I went to the demo and I had my mind blown just like they did.
Sure.
And they had big successful companies, so they hired the brains out there.
Said,
I went home and
it.
Started building
interesting
more user friendly apps and really focused on.
Were you interested in windowing?
Well, yeah. And so what I did was I set out to build myself a windowing environment. And it sat on top of Windows. Or it sat on top of DOS.
Just as Windows did originally. And Windows was just a shell on top of DOS.
I mean, they could get more intimate because they owned DOS. I didn't, so I was more arm's length. But what I was doing was building this graphics platform so I could do. I was working on a geographic information system.
Oh, how interesting. Was it using just the 80 by 24 screen? Was it using like NCurses? And
It was 80 by 24. And and so.
So you were using character graphics and things to create
that's
Windows.
That's what Super Project was.
Right.
Now, what happened is when I sold it to CA, they. They moved it forward to so it would run on
Windows
on more competent graphics cards.
Right.
And
but in the early days, I mean, I remember very well. You know, there were graphical characters, there were glyphs within the character sets that you could draw lines and boxes.
And I used those to have little boxes and lines and connect them to critical path. And it was and you could enter. I mean, there were
and we critical. Were happy. We were happy. That was enough for us.
So. So what Super Project did, there were critical path programs that existed. But what you did is you entered your information in a tabular way, and it would print out the charts.
Yeah.
I made it so you could enter the charts,
directly.
And it would print out the tabular information.
Oh, interesting.
And so it was pretty revolutionary.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a buddy of mine said he knew I was working on this stuff, and he took me to a Microsoft, essentially a revival meeting in a tent with what's his name, Ballmer, up there.
Elmer Ballmer.
Saying, we're going to make the 640K barrier go away. We're going to give you, you know, dynamic relocation. And I said, dynamic relocation? Boy, I want that.
Yeah.
And so I came home and I started working on Windows.
Yeah.
And the first thing you learned in 82 or something about Windows is their shell sucked.
Right.
It sucked so badly, it just stank up the place. Everybody knew it. It was an embarrassment. And, you know, it was not an important product for Microsoft.
Right.
So they didn't give it the resources.
It's Windows 1 or maybe a little?
No, it was 0.83 or something like that. It was still
very
zero.
Early, before 1. Okay.
And so I went home and I said, this needs a shell. And I started to work on the shell. And then I encountered this problem. It's like, well, what does a shell look like?
Do you mean the shell like command line shell? Is that what you mean?
Only it's not a command line because it's graphics.
Right.
So what does it look like? What does it do? And
this is when you start thinking about UI.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I was, and as as it began to become clear to me that the really interesting ideas come to you when you go out in the field and listen to actual humans instead of breathing your exhaust back in the office listening to other programmers, is I was in the field and I was talking to a senior executive at a bank who had was buying 100,000 seats of Windows, and he goes, I really want to be able to run these programs, but a lot of the people I have are, they're not programmers, they're not technical, and I just want to be able to push a button and run an app. And the light went on. I realized, and I went home and I started working on what I called a shell construction set.
Ah, now we're getting somewhere. That's right. Now we're getting to VB. Hold on, hold that thought. I want to take a break. Alan Cooper is our guest. He's the father of Visual Basic, but he hates his children. You should have written Visual C. Now, there would be a product.
We talked about Visual C. It was actually on the table.
That'd be interesting.
And I would have voted for that.
Yeah.
But Bill doesn't like C.
Nope. And, you know, I like the construction set. I think that was a big transformation. We'll talk about that in a second. Our show today brought to you by Wealthfront. If you are investing for the long term, and you need to be, right, for retirement, for college fund, for your kids, your grandkids, you need to think about maybe you want to buy a house, saving up for a down payment. You've got to have long-term investments. That's just the right thing to do. The real challenge is, where do you put your money? How do you invest it? You don't put it in a savings account or a certificate of deposit because the interest rate is so low that really you might as well just put it in your mattress. At the same time, if you go to a financial advisor, they charge a lot of money, between 1 to 3% of what they manage, plus all these hidden fees and transaction costs. That means you have to make that much more just to break even. That's not a great solution either, because it's hard. I admit it's hard nowadays to make money in your investments. That's why you got to try Wealthfront. Wealthfront does not charge 1, 2, or 3% of what you invest every year. They charge 0.25%, 25 basis points. And there are never any commissions or hidden fees. That's it. That's the total cost. And Wealthfront does it so inexpensively because it's a computer. It's software. But it's software designed by some of the best investment minds out there, people like Charles D. Ellis and Burton Malkiel, people who really understand the market, and they've encapsulated in the software fundamental algorithms that work. And unlike a financial advisor or even you, if you're doing it yourself, these algorithms are working constantly on your behalf. You don't rebalance every quarter or every month or even every week. They're looking every minute by minute to rebalance, reinvest, to do things like tax loss harvesting. So you get the highest return, but you also reduce your tax bill. And that's just as important, right? The intake process is based on Nobel Prize-winning academic research. So when you go there, in fact, you can do this for free. In fact, I would do this. I'm not saying sign up yet. Go to wealthfront.com/triangulation and get a sample portfolio generated so you can see what they would be investing in. You will do it, and you'll see how easy this is. Just a few questions about your risk tolerance, about your time frame, things like that. They can generate this portfolio. They will, this is another free service, take a look at your existing investments and see where you're perhaps not fully diversified, how risky it is, what you're losing the fees, minimize taxes, maximize return, all of that. And that's all for free. Go to wealthfront.com/triangulation. They have now a variety of long-term investment plans, including they've just added 529 college savings plans, which is kind of like a Roth IRA, but for college savings. So if you are putting aside money for your kids, this is a great investment tool. They manage right now $3 billion in assets. It's been going up like crazy because people realize, I read an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of months ago saying how scared traditional human advisors are of Wealthfront because this works. And by the way, if you decide, after you read about it, and I want you to do that, go to wealthfront.com/triangulation. If you decide you want to do it, you start with as little as $500. But the deal that they're offering our listeners, which I think is great, is your first $15,000 is managed, not for 0.25%, but free, 0% forever. So you can start that nest egg and really maximize the return. Go to wealthfront.com/triangulation. It's a great company. And they do a great job. And I think if you read about it, don't trust me, read about it. I think you'll see what I'm saying. Wealthfront.com/triangulation. At least get the free portfolio. Alan Cooper is our guest. Cooper.com is his website. He is legendary for his books about user interface design and really doing it right. In fact, you wrote a book. you said it was from the last century, that I wish people would be paying more attention to, because it asks kind of the fundamental question that everybody who's designing software should be asking. There's about face, which is the essentials of interaction design. And then there's the one, what's the one before it that I love the title of?
It's actually was after it. That was the after first it. One. The
okay.
one after it is called The Inmates Are Running the Asylum.
That's it. Alan, it's great to have you. Great raconteur, full of great stories. So you thought this is the earliest days of GUIs, really.
Yeah. Now, I just have to say that I love this history, and I could talk for about six more hours, but we need to get up to
I want to know what you're doing now.
Current stuff.
Don't worry.
But, okay, good.
Don't worry. We're almost there.
Good, good, good.
We're practically there now.
So so I had this epiphany that it was a construction set is the way the shell needed to be, in that there were people who needed to do pretty complicated things with the shell, and there were people who needed to do dead simple things with it. And so the idea came about that there's a use mode and an authoring mode. And so I created this tool, and you could drag and drop. And I was the first guy to do drag and drop
so
on
buttons
Windows.
And controls and all of this stuff.
And that was the other thing.
UI.
Is that the controls were Microsoft had created a facility to allow with their dynamic libraries to add to programs dynamically.
Yeah.
But nobody had ever used it. Nobody ever figured out a practical use for it.
Huh.
And I
you
was
mean
the
while they're
guy.
Running or wow.
I was the first guy to do it. Hmm. And so I used Microsoft's facility, their dynamic relocation and their DDEs there, and so what you could do is you could write a piece of my construction set had like I think there were like 9 controls. But all of them were independent libraries with their own internal APIs talking to the API of this shell program that I wrote, which was called Ruby. What you could do, it was just a code name, what you could do is you could write your own control that did whatever you wanted, and as long as you followed the protocol and talked to the APIs, the program would recognize it at runtime and include it and put its icon up, add it to all the menus, and interact with it. And this blew Microsoft's mind. They had never seen this stuff before.
Yeah.
I mean, they were systems guys, so they built the facilities to support it, but they couldn't imagine how it might be used.
Right.
Okay. But
and now it's commonplace.
Yeah.
But that was the first time.
So, but Microsoft was in the middle of a pitched battle between the Windows guys, which were the outcasts and the misfits within the organization,
really?
And the OS2 guys, which were the,
oh,
these
yeah,
were the main
the
guys.
Next
this is a strategic
thing.
Product
yeah.
and a strategic relationship with
yeah.
IBM.
Yeah.
And
Ed Iacobucci. Yeah.
And they when they cut themselves loose from IBM, everybody thought, you know, it's like the ship at the dock, you know, cutting the mooring lines,
right.
and the dock sank.
Right.
That was Microsoft and IBM. Nobody expected that. And so one of the things you could do with Ruby is in about 10 minutes, you could clone the OS2 shell using, I mean, you could just build it.
Wow.
Okay, from scratch.
Wow.
They came in with a bunch of technicalities. They said, well, it's not quite pixel for pixel perfect, and it's not quite keystroke for keystroke perfect, but it was about 95% you could do it. And so they said, you can't have it because it...
Oh, no, you're kidding.
So they threw it out, and so there went the shell construction set, easy to use for users.
Oh.
And at that point, Ruby then became an orphan within Microsoft, and nobody knew what to do with it.
You had written it for them as a consultant? Or
well, I took it to Bill Gates, and I showed it to him.
Them?
I said, look at this. He said, we want to buy this. And I said, great. And we worked out a deal.
Right.
And Gates showed up at my house with a bottle of champagne and the contract.
Nice.
Yeah. And so we inked the deal.
Nice.
And that's why I'm a self-made thousandaire. And so
Bill was a good negotiator.
Yes. I said I want a royalty of a nickel a unit. He said, no. So I said, okay, good. But what I want written into the contract, I mean, I knew I was not going to get rich off this, but I said, I want written into the contract the fact that I can publicize this because this is going to be my resume.
Yes. Yes.
So, and that's why I'm the father of Visual Basic.
Yeah. Visual Basic, of course, much more than that. But that's the fundamental thing you see when you use Visual Basic. Even today, that's what you see, right?
Well, I like to say I did the visual and they did the basic.
They did the basic.
Or as I like to say, it's like sending your kid off to college and he comes back summa cum laude with a sex change operation. And you kind of have to say, well, that's my boy.
He's still my boy. Or
my girl, yeah. And, you know, so it took me a while to grapple with that and to come to terms with it. Finally, I said, okay, I'm just going to – I mean, what you discover in the high-tech world is that the things that the world – lionizes you for are stuff that you did on a weekend when you hung over, and the stuff you slave for years over, nobody notices.
Yep.
And it's
that's just the way it is. Yeah. The inmates are running the asylum. Why high-tech products drive us crazy, and how to restore sanity. And that's from, as you said, the last century.
Yeah.
And they still drive us crazy.
Yeah. That was published in 99. Well, so I built a company to do this, and, you know, there are people out there who are writers, who write stuff. I'm not a writer. I'm a doer, and I wrote about what I did. And
today we'd call you a maker, right? Somebody who makes things.
Yes. Yeah. And so for the last, 18 years or so, I've been kind of the spokesman for a company. So if I wrote a book today, it would be about speaking. And there are smarter guys than I who are doing this work.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No.
But it must drive you crazy to see how stuff you look at it, must look at it and go, wow, that's just so bad.
You know, as a designer, I'm a professional critic. Right. And as a programmer, I'm a perfectionist. And so, but on the other hand, the other day, one of the things that I said in my first book, which was published in 95, as I said, there should be no error messages, none whatsoever.
I completely agree. They're useless to the end user.
This was crazy talk in 95. It was heresy. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. People actively yelled at me. I mean, physically got angry.
What if there's an error? What are we going to do?
Exactly. And so I just want to say that just the other day I was getting retro, and I said, I want to find some of the worst error messages out there. So I did a search, and you know what? There aren't any.
There are no more error messages?
No, they're really gone. I mean, there are error messages that basically say your system has just utterly rolled over and died.
You still get a blue screen. In fact, it's amazing. Microsoft's
biggest
accomplishment with Windows 10 is to bring the blue screen of death back. I'm so grateful to them. Thank you for that.
But really, software, apps, programs that do work for people.
They don't bark on you.
They used to constantly
put
up, that's wrong. What do you
mean? Remember the browser used to say, there's a JavaScript program on this page that's not running properly. What would you like me to do? And like, what do you mean, what would you like me to do? I didn't write it. Yeah. I don't have anything to do with it. I can't change it.
An error has occurred.
It's
so, the passive voice.
So they have finally listened a little bit.
I
think we still see them, but I think you're right, though. They're not nowhere near the degree they used to be.
Exactly. That's really what it is. And so, again, what you have to do is you have to sit back and say, is it perfect? No. Are we making forward progress? Yes.
Yeah.
And the basic level of behavior that you see in software systems today is far greater than it was, 25 years ago.
Hallelujah. I'm glad to hear you say that. I'm not sure I believe it.
Well,
it's frustrating. I live in software all the time, right? So I get more frustration than
you live in cutting edge software.
Yeah.
And cutting edge software is going to exhibit
it's
that
gonna
behavior.
Cut you. Yep.
Exactly.
I love it. Compy386 says, when I was in tech support, users would call up offended that we had accused them of doing something illegal. Illegal operation. That didn't do anything illegal. What are you talking about?
I know. Lawyers will be knocking at your door.
Illegal operation.
The thing is that if you're a tech guy, when your computer gives you an error message,
you know what to do about it.
Well, you can assess it in the context of that it's a machine that has just had issues.
Right. Normal users, it's like...
Normal users, they look at it and they go, that's the voice of authority and perfection. And it has just informed me of my failure.
I have failed it.
And that's not okay. I mean, that's the thing. The idea is that the technologists look at this as tech, but the users of technology don't. Yeah. They don't see it as tech.
That's changed a lot, though. I mean, when in the 70s and 80s and even 90s, when people used technology, they knew they were using technology. But today, it's so pervasive that it's just our life. It's our phone. It's our TV set. It's our microwave oven. It's our my Tesla crashed the other day. Not into a car. The software
it's running
on
Windows,
the screen said, I can't go on. Please press the, you know, there's this little clicky wheels.
It's a control alt delete.
So you press those and you hold them for 5 seconds to reboot the center console.
I can't go
what?
On.
It's a car. But nowadays we live in technology.
So in the inmates, I ask what I pose the riddle for the information age, which is what do you get when you cross a toaster with a computer? Logic tells you you get a smart toaster, but what you really get is a computer with heated bread slots. That's because the dominant behavior is as of a computer. And by the way, it'll also brown your bread. And so what do you get when you cross a camera with a computer? You don't get a smart camera. You get a computer that, by the way, has a lens. What do you get when you cross a car with a computer?
You get a computer with wheels.
That's right. Yep. It's and interacting with it. It's, you know, when I die, they're going to pry me out of the wreckage with my hand on the nav system.
Yeah, yeah, that's probably true. Me too. All right, I do want to find out what you're doing now. We could go on and on about chickens and Sauls and Z80s and 8088s. You were telling me.
But all the normal people would go, what are those old farts talking about?
No, there is no normal people watching. That's the beauty of this network. Everybody who's watching is going, yeah, I remember that. We were talking before we got started about...
That's really sad.
No, it's great. We're among friends. Okay. Alan. We're among friends here. It's okay.
All right.
We're all geeks on this bus. You were talking before we got going on the show, we were talking about Bill Gates and the 640K limit, and you blame him for that.
Well, I blame him for everything, basically. Why not?
Well, he was so dominant, but Intel had something to do with it too, right? I mean, Andy Grove had a little.
Well, what they did was they said the 8086 architecture was going to be backward compatible to the 8080 architecture, and
that was the holy grail for Microsoft, was backward compatibility.
I know, and what they achieved was backward.
Yeah, no, that's true.
You
still have segmented memory architecture on an 88 and an x86.
Steve Jobs said, I'm not going to pander to the past. And he went forward.
Yeah.
And by doing so, he has people fighting to throw away last year's phone.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it was two, there were no more fundamental disagreements
right there
between Jobs and Gates than those two. Gates dragged his tail around and Jobs chopped it off every year.
Yeah.
I mean, the Apple II wasn't compatible with the Apple I, wasn't compatible with the Apple III, wasn't compatible with the Lisa, wasn't compatible with the Mac, wasn't compatible with yada, yada, yada.
Didn't have to be. He didn't care. He wanted to make the best thing. You know, that would be a fun, sometime we'll have to do that, is just, here we are, we're finally at the end of that era. Look back and see what choices people made and what the end, we finally can see the end result. I mean, we got a whole new race running. Don't know what the end result that's going to be, but I think we can look back at the last race and see.
Well, the market tells.
Yeah, it does ultimately.
I
don't know. I don't agree. Sometimes you see great technologies, BOS, the market never embraced, and they just die.
Yeah.
Not first to market. It's not the best technology. Best technology rarely, or not rarely, but often does not succeed.
You know, I've learned many lessons on my farm. Yes. West Petaluma.
Yes.
And one of them is that not all of the cute little lammies survive.
Sometimes mutton.
Yeah.
Let's take a little break. I want to find out what you're doing now on the farm with the lammies. Maybe I don't. Our show. You know what? I'm going to show you some cool technology. For a long time, fiber optic. That was a magic term, right? Fiber optic. Glass fibers that carry huge amounts of data at the speed of light. We felt like copper was so old-fashioned. Fiber is the new thing, right? And it still is. You know, you say, we've got fiber internet here, thanks to Sonic. We've got fiber. That's the latest and greatest. And yet still, all of our cables, you know, our USB cables, even our Thunderbolt cables, they're copper. Well, the kings of fiber, the guys who know glass better than anybody, Corning, have created new fiber optic cables suitable for your home. And this is a revolution. So these are glass cables. They're fiber optic cables. Unlike earlier versions of earlier fiber optic cables were very fragile. You know, if you did that, you would get somebody yelling at you. You can crimp these. You can bend these. This is glass. But it works with your USB 3.0 ports or your Thunderbolt ports because of this thing at the end of the cable. This converts the copper signals into light. And then on the other end, there's a similar thing that receives and turns it back into copper. And you get the benefit of fiber optic with incredibly strong and flexible cables with all the old traditional connectors, the USB 3.0 connectors, the Thunderbolt cables. And you're going to love this because that means, first of all, these cables, you can see they're lots thinner, they're a lot lighter, they're very robust, and they go a long way. For Thunderbolt, 60 meters, 200 feet. For USB, yeah, I know. I know, 50 meters
amazing, yeah,
for USB. So if you think about it, here's an example. Universal Audio, they make Thunderbolt audio interfaces, very high-end for recording studios and things like that. They have, of course, a place where they test their audio equipment. They don't want to have the hard drives, the noisy stuff in that quiet studio. They use optical cables like by Corning to get acoustic isolation. They just take all of the noisy stuff and they put it outside. I use it at home. I've got a massive Drobo array with five spinning hard drives. Is it noisy? A little bit. I don't want it on my desk. I'll put it this way. You know, I have everything's SSDs on the desk, but when the Drobo's on the desk, you could feel slight vibration as the stuff's spinning. What do? You take a Thunderbolt or USB 3.0 cable, and you connect it, and you put the Drobo under the desk or outside as far away as you want. They're the masters of glass. Hot swappable. You can daisy chain six Thunderbolt devices. You can bend. You can walk on them. They're ultra slim, ultra light. And, you know, even when they're knotted and tangled, which is, I'm sorry to say, I'm embarrassed to say, kind of what it looks like under my desk, they still work. I say they take a bending and they keep on sending. This is the fabulous new cables. You can save big. They're available at Apple stores, B&H, Amazon. But if you go to Corning, Corning.com/twit, you can save up to $130 on their Thunderbolt optical cables. Now, this offer is only valid for a little more time till August 31st or while supplies last, whichever occurs first. I guess they still have some because they're still telling us that we can do it. So go to Corning.com/twit. Get these cables, these amazing Thunderbolt cables. They also have USB 3.0 cables. Corning.com/twit. I'm sure you'll find an application for it. It is amazing. And takes a bending and keeps on sending is not their official slogan. I just made that up. Who was the guy who said that about Timex?
John Cameron Swayze.
That's it. John Cameron Swayze for Timex. It takes a licking and it keeps on ticking. See, I like talking to people my age. This is why you see old-timers sitting on benches talking to each other. Because young people, they don't remember John Cameron Swayze. So what I love about you, though, is you do not rest on your laurels. What are you doing today? What's going on in Cooper.com?
Well, you know, that's the thing about building software and actually shipping it, is that you learn how much the stuff that you thought was God's gift to great behavior, software technical behavior, you find that people struggle with it.
Yeah.
And so I began to realize that.
Even today, you'd think everybody would know, right?
Yeah, I began to realize that the really interesting and challenging problem wasn't building bug-free, feature-packed software, but it was making software that people actually liked and liked to use and could be productive with.
Yeah.
And so I mean,
it's hard enough to do the former, but the latter is almost impossible.
Yeah. Well, it's about as impossible as the former used to be.
Right.
I mean, it's a solvable problem.
Yeah.
And
but it's not tools that'll help you. Tools help you make buggy, less buggy software. How do you make more usable software?
Well, you tools.
Is it?
Yeah. Sure.
And it's not changing your thinking. It's not a new way of thinking about it.
So you need tools to change your thinking.
Yeah.
You don't need programming tools. You don't need software tools.
Right.
But you need ways of approaching problems.
Okay, good.
And so that's who I am. That's what I do. I'm a maker. I'm an inventor. And tools have always been my focus.
Right. Okay?
That's what I'm interested in.
Right.
And so I began to, I knew that I had invented successful software before. And when I finally, in 1992, I said to my colleagues and my friends, I said, well, I'm a consultant now for the first time ever, and I'll help you make your software easier to use and more liked by your users. And I did it based on just my experience and my you know, native wit.
Your gut.
Yeah, my gut. Yeah. But at the same time, I said, I was asking myself, is this a system?
Right.
You know, is there something here that you could extract and you could systematize and you could write about and you could pass on to other people, you could teach to others? And so I began to say, well, what is going on in my head when I'm thinking about this stuff? And I began to come up with a series of tools that I began to teach to others. And that's what I wrote about in About Face and then in The Inmates. So all technologists always approach problems by first establishing their constraints. They first say, what is it we can't do? And then let's navigate between the rocks. Mm-hmm. That's how engineers work. Mm-hmm. That's a fine way of working. Mm-hmm. But this is not an engineering problem. Creating well-behaved software is not an engineering problem.
That might explain why engineers seem to have such a difficult time doing it.
You know, and I love engineers. You know,
yeah. Well, you need them.
I've walked a million miles in their shoes, but it's a
different mindset.
It's a parallel problem, and yeah. We need to work in tandem with attacking these two problems. One is solving the problem from the computer out, and the other is solving the problem from the user in. And so, the way the user approaches it is they're kind of going, well, I don't get why it just doesn't do it for me.
Right.
Why can't I just push the go button and have it all done? So we invented, and we literally had to invent a game that we play, which is a bona fide design tool that is used in the field today. We call Pretend It's Magic, which is how do you go about designing how software will behave? You pretend it's magic. What if I could just snap my fingers and have it do whatever it is I wanted?
Right.
Okay. Well, at that point, what you do is you realize that half of the stuff that programmers are building, you could throw out. It's there because that's the way they did it when it was paper. And you don't really need it.
No, that's true.
Okay. Well,
we're duplicating old processes.
There's a huge savings right there.
Yeah.
But
now, how hard is that to do? Does that require the programmer really do a lot more work?
No. Usually it means they do less.
They do less.
Here's the thing is from a programmer's point of view, all their code passes through the WASP waste of the central processing unit.
Right.
So every single line of code has the ability to crash and bring down the whole system.
Yeah.
Okay. So every single line of code has to be just as perfect as every other single line of code. Okay. So the way programmers approach things is a uniform level of quality. But the problem is inside a computer, there's code that executes once when it starts and code that executes once when it shuts down. Code that executes never when there's a weird out-of-line problem, and then there's code that's executed a million times in the average daily use by the user.
Right.
From a design point of view, you need to focus all your efforts on that million-use average stuff, and you don't have to worry too much about that other stuff. Engineering is good enough for the stuff that happens once at the beginning and once at the
end. You optimize the inner loops.
And so what you can do is you can focus your design efforts on the stuff that the user is going to hit with regularity.
Yeah.
And if you make that really easy to use, then you make the whole thing a lot easier to use.
So what are the tools that have focus groups? Do you do watch users? Do you do heat mapping? What is it that what tools can you use?
Well, a lot of that stuff is marketing, and which is different. Marketing is about how do you make a demographic love you?
Right.
And what we do is interaction design, which is how do you make users love you?
Oh, that's
interesting. And they're very different things.
That's interesting.
So the key is you have to get out and listen to your users. And you would be amazed how many companies today don't do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I am not amazed because I watch users struggle and suffer, and they're so unhappy. And it's clear that the companies at some point abandoned users' interests.
Well, It's just really, really easy to focus on what you do.
Yeah.
And what you do is you build this artifact.
Right.
And you start looking at the artifact and you start saying, well, it could do this or it could do that or we could improve it here. And the thing is you have to be coming at it from your user's point of view. So
give me an example.
One of our clients is, we did this work a year or so ago, is United Mileage Plus. Mm-hmm. They're an issuer of credit cards, of Visa cards.
I have their Visa card.
As I do too. And they came to us. They asked us to help them send out more ads because they wanted more exposure. Okay, and we said, well, you know, we went out and we listened to their actual users. And lo and behold, the users didn't want more ads.
No, really? Wow.
A shock, okay. I know.
Yeah.
And they wanted a greater engagement. You know, they used their cards.
We want a relationship.
Exactly. So the VP who is in charge.
Instead of talking at me, talk with me. Is that a way to put it? Because ads are just talking at you often, right?
Yeah. Well,
let's have a conversation.
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
We don't know. We don't know what it is until we go out there.
Right.
So I'm saying we came back and we said they want more engagement. But you see, but this is very symptomatic. Is it, they fired us.
Well, we don't want to do that.
Because
what else can we
do? They said, we didn't hire you to go out and do interviews. We hired you to do product design.
Right. We want to look at what you're on the screen.
So we had to talk them out of the tree. We had to say, no, wait a minute.
Yeah.
We're here to help. And so what we did is we said, what users want is not more stuff shoved down the pipe at their face, but they want more engagement. So what we did is we invented an application that we built the front end, they built the back end, and they put it out there, and it's called the X app. And what it is a really interesting kind of a shopping app is that the way it works is you when you're about to buy something, you get miles when you buy something, right?
Right.
But what you can do is you can when you're about to buy, you know, a new, you know, earrings or refrigerator or something, you can type in what it is in your app and it generates a gift card on the spot. And then the retailer scans your gift card on your celly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, what happens is you get your miles for the purchase through the card, but all of a sudden you get all the benefits of the gift card, including extra benefits, extra miles and stuff given to you by Mileage Plus. So they do $100 million a year annually on this product. And they've got a 35% usage. This is what they fired us because they thought, they said, why are you wasting our time? And we said, well, no, this is not actually wasting your time. But that's the normal, is that there's all this focus inside the industry on products. It matters where the buttons are.
Right.
So, no, this is not about art and skeuomorphism. This is about who are your users? What is their desired end state?
What do they want?
What is motivating them to get there? And if we understand that, we will help you design and build software that will be very good for your business. And this is the truly remarkable thing, is that I come at this from a practitioner, formerly a developer, and I've invented these tools that are just very simple. How do we design interaction? But it turns out that if your tools for designing interaction are sufficiently powerful, they have strategic effect on your entire business. Namely, it used to be what was important in business was what am I doing? What is the service that I'm providing to my users? How can I make that service be more powerful? Okay, but it turns out that what you're doing is really kind of a commodity these days. Everybody
it
can
is,
provide
isn't it?
Whatever it is.
Yeah, and there's friction-free transit between businesses.
So what matters is how you deliver it.
Mm-hmm.
The behavior, the touch points of your applications, your programs, your whatever faces the world. And it's not about understanding the functionality. You need to understand the functionality, but that's just table stakes. What you need to do is you need to know what's in the head of your users. So, well, this is all of our tools are all for identifying users and understanding what their motivations and desired end states are. Turns out that this is more important strategically to a business than what you're building, how you market it, how you finance your organization. It certainly isn't manufacturing because all that stuff is commoditized and offshored.
Right.
And
it seems so obvious. And it's but I can see also how businesses, they get myopic, they get short-sighted, they get focused on, well, no, we have this product. We need to make this product better. They lose sight of what their business is, which is making customers happy, right?
So it's so easy. I mean, you know, if what you do for a living is it's Dunning-Kruger. It's getting lost in the forest for the trees. It's so much about focusing on the work you do. And their expertise, I mean, what we don't do, and there are designers, designers with a capital D, aesthetic designers, who talk about my artistic vision. We don't have any of those. We don't do that. Because it's not about your
You don't
artistic
start
vision.
With that. That's,
we don't do that at yeah, all. Yeah. We do visual design, but right. visual design is always in service
It has to of the start with the goals. User. It has to start with the
what
user.
What are you trying to accomplish, yeah. Yeah. and why are you trying
Sometimes
to accomplish
I feel like that's the big mistake design-focused companies make, is they're really imposing on users their vision. And I think Apple, for instance, is a good example where as they've gotten more and more focused on their own sensibility, they've lost sight of making the customer, bringing joy to the customer. You know what I'm saying? Johnny Ive seems to be more interested in Johnny Ive. And you don't have to respond to this. I don't want to be
politic. I am politic. Not going to dispute a word you're
yeah,
saying.
Yeah.
And as far
but
as
it's I'm an easy, and by the way, this is not a knock on Apple. This is what happens. This is the natural
this
progression.
This is why I call myself an Alexandrian designer.
Right.
Because I'm
right.
not a designer who says, you will build my vision.
Right.
Because it's not about right. my vision. Right. It's about solving a problem presented by the outside world. The thing is artists can, you know, they can hurl paint at the wall and say, you know,
you
that's
take it
my
or leave
vision.
It. That's my art. You take it or leave it.
We don't
you like
do
it or not, I don't care.
We say, are people using this? Are they right. loving it? Are they coming right. back for more? If so, that's a success.
Right.
If they're not, it doesn't matter how beautiful right. it is.
And a company, and this is the peril of success, because as a company becomes successful, they start to buy into their own mythology. Oh, we know when you even hear Apple virtually say this, we know what's best.
Right. Well, and they did when Jobs was at the helm, yeah. because what Jobs was doing is he was relentlessly focusing on customer satisfaction.
Yeah.
Now he was the representative customer.
That's the point, right?
But he was a representative.
But he was representative, yeah.
He did it. And most
he could say, what do I like? It was enough to say that because he represented the audience.
I can't do that.
Yeah.
Because
nor can I.
I'm not representative.
Yeah.
And as a rule of thumb,
it's a dangerous, it's a perilous road.
That's right. You are not representative.
Steve Jobs.
You can't be representative.
Yeah.
And if you think you're representative because you have a vision, what you're going to do is you're going to build some magnificent monument to yesterday.
Right.
And
yeah. Yeah. Well, and as this is a more mature industry now, and that's exactly what you'd expect in a more mature industry.
So we're victims of our own success.
Exactly.
This is really interesting. Exactly. What's going on is when Cooper, my consulting company, first started, I told the troops, I said, we're doing three things. Not only are we building a company, but we're inventing a practice and we're establishing a profession. Okay, there was no such thing as
new
an interaction
profession.
Designer back
yeah,
then,
yeah.
and there were no ways to do it. So we invented tools like personas, you know, which is
What's
widely
that?
Used across the industry.
Oh, I think we did this with our design team when we started doing the website.
When in 2000, when I was on your screensaver show, I unveiled the magic of personas, your show, and I had a little picture, a little stand-up
yeah.
card, and the staff fell in love with it, and they asked me if they could keep it.
Oh, really?
And they put it in the background.
Oh, how funny!
Sales, and every week on
you'd
the
see
show,
your you'd it, see
it,
your.
It was a stock photo, and we named her Polly.
I remember this.
And
yes,
Polly moved
yes.
around in the studio.
I do remember Polly. Yeah.
So
we did that with when we designed the website. The designers, the team said, "All right, we're going to create some users. We're going to describe some people who are using your site."
The thing is that
personify
is,
that
is they need to be based on actual.
Yeah, not what
studies
we think.
Studies in the field.
Yeah.
It's not what we
yeah.
think. It's what you actually
yeah.
find out there.
Yeah.
But when you find it, if you interview 10 people,
you'll find them.
You'll detect very clear patterns, but you'll also detect idiosyncrasies. So instead of having to give exceptions and footnotes, what you do is you just take one synthetic person and you give them the common attributes. And then
it's
you
one
can
of the
manipulate.
Reasons we have a chat room. It's one of the reasons we try to. One of the problems with broadcasting is it's broadcasting. It's somebody talking to the other people and not listening, more talking than listening. And I've been very interested. It's very difficult. It's challenging. But I've been very interested in how we can listen better as we're talking. And the chat room is one of the yeah. outcomes of that, to have live, real-time feedback from people.
And most field research tends to be very marketing-oriented. It's very structured. There's a questionnaire.
Yeah, yeah.
And the kind of work we do is all open-ended. It's all
essay nothing
questions.
But bad results from focus groups. That does not work.
Well, they're valuable in some situations. For designing the behavior right. of your touch points, no, not so much.
Yeah. But I think so, what you really want to do is have a conversation, an ongoing conversation with your customers.
You want to, as I'm fond of saying, our best interviewing tool is two beers.
I agree.
In vino veritas.
Yes.
You know? And what you do is you listen to people and you ask them the kind of questions like, have you ever had a bad day using our product?
Oh, that's an interesting
question.
And
then you shut up and listen. And wow. They go, oh, no, never had a bad day. And then
well, there was
up,
this one
and then,
time.
Then that's right. And then it starts coming out. And then they flip up their keyboard and it's the bottom is covered with post-its.
So now that you ask.
So here's the thing is business people have gotten the memo. Design makes a difference. The behavior of their touch points to the world make a difference. And what they've done is they've said, we need some of that there design stuff. And so what they've done is they've begun hiring design staffs. Yeah. Yeah. And some of them have even gone out and acquired consulting companies. Some of our peers have been acquired. Yeah. And today, our biggest competition is in-house design staff.
Huh.
Okay? Because all of our clients now have
sure.
these people on staff sure. doing it. But what they're all finding is it's a lot harder than they thought.
Yeah.
As it turns out that if you bring in a bunch of designers, magic doesn't happen.
Right.
Because you have to have a design-sensitive culture. And everybody wants change, but nobody wants to change.
Right.
And the problem
right.
is you got to right. change. So what we find ourselves doing more and more is working with organizations and helping their internal teams to figure out how to communicate and how to be more effective, because there's,
you need an outsider to do that. You can't, it's hard to do. You get co-opted once you're inside.
There's, you do, you, because you bring perspective and,
the outside team does. Yeah.
So I can talk a little bit about this other project, but I can't name the client because okay. otherwise they'll kill me. It was another financial services organization, but they had a design team internally. They wanted to, you can just imagine the president of the company going, looking at his son or daughter and going, we got to talk to these millennials.
Kids, it's all about the kids today.
So there was this corporate mandate, you yeah. know, we got to talk to the millennials. Right. And so they right. came to us and they said, how do we talk to these leading edgers, these millennials? Right. We really need to communicate
Every
with
company in the world is saying that right now.
I know. Okay. And so what we did is we came in.
Mostly because they're baffling, by the way.
They are baffling. But guess what? Young people have always baffled old people.
Yes,
it's
right.
not about
it's
the millennials.
New.
I mean, I remember as a teenage boomer freaking out all yeah. the old Eisenhower guys.
Yeah.
And so what we did is, rather than taking that at face value, is we went out and we started talking to their users, or I should say listening to their users.
Their current users. Yeah.
And what we found is that the people who are doing interesting things with their product spanned age boundaries.
Right.
There were just as many old people
right.
as there were millennials who were wrestling with these issues. And the company was a kind of a back-end company, and they had a layer of organizations that they did business with who faced users. And so what we ended up doing was creating essentially a board game for them to play, to act out, to go out and find their own personas and figure out ways to create product value. And they loved it because it gave them an engagement through the hierarchy of
right.
their organization.
Right.
And essentially it was...
Was it a literal board game?
Like literally a board game
wow.
with little cardboard pieces. But what it did was it forced them to do some of this field work, and it forced them to ask, well, why would somebody want this? Not just they're a millennial and we want to sell
right.
them stuff.
Right.
But why would somebody out there want our services?
Much better. Much better question.
It was remarkable. And this is what we're discovering is I should stop and say that about 12 or 14 years ago, what we did is we created what we called Cooper U, which was our training arm. We decided that we had all these tools and all these processes and methods that were really powerful, and we should teach people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started offering classes. And now Cooper U is an established part of our business. We do a lot of in-house corporate-level training, and we do a lot of open enrollment classes for people from all over the world fly to San Francisco. We give the classes, and we take our coursework on the road. And so training inside organizations is one of the things we're really good at. So what we're finding is that our best clients are coming to us and they all have a specific problem. They all say, we need you to fix this thing. But in order to fix the thing, you can't just fix it and then walk out.
Right.
You have to fix the team.
Right. And they may not really know what they need to have fixed.
Right. So it's
they may be saying, how do we get millennials?
And And so it's a study of the organization.
Yeah. Of
and
course.
It's a study of their processes.
Of course.
And it's a training. We call it the passing the baton.
Yeah.
You're not just doing work for them, but you're also empowering them to do it in the future.
Cooper.com if people want to learn more. And the books are there as well about FACE, the essentials of interaction design, designing for the digital age. And it's really a thrill to see you again and to talk with you again. I just enjoy so much reminiscing, and I apologize for spending so much time in the past, but that's exciting what you're doing in the future.
That's
too.
What
and
old
I think
farts
it needs to
do.
Be
yeah. Spend time
that's
in
what
the
we
past.
Do. We need a pickle barrel and checkerboard. Alan Cooper, cooper.com. We do try. By the way, thank you for putting up with the first triangulation in our new studio. There are a lot of glitches. We were had an hour late getting started because all sorts of things have to be wired and wired anew.
I love
I appreciate
all this
it.
Technology.
Yeah, it's kind of fun.
It's really cool.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. So, we got a great team.
Do you have time for some pictures?
Pictures, yeah.
I brought some pictures to show you.
Pictures, sure. Did you bring Polly?
No, I didn't bring Polly, but
I miss Polly.
So this is the house we bought 5 years ago.
Yeah.
This is what it looked like before we purchased it, called Monkey Ranch.
That's where the eggs came from.
And
Monkey
that's
Ranch
where the eggs.
Eggs
came from.
Yep.
But so one of the barns on the property.
This is where where Renegada got
that's
stuck.
That's the barn. That's the
Holy
hay barn.
Holy cow! I didn't realize it was that big.
That's the before picture.
Yeah,
and where Renegada was way back in the corner, and this is what it looks like today.
Wow! Now this I want to visit.
It's
your maker space.
It's my dream workshop.
Wow!
So this is what it looks like from the outside.
Wow!
It's that barn there.
What a dream! You know, one of the nice things about being in this area is there are barns.
Yes,
there are a lot of barns, and repurposing a barn to make the perfect geek paradise.
So that's
what
I
do in there? It looks like a laboratory.
So my workshop, it was. I just wanted a small workshop. That's all I wanted. But when we bought the farm, it had seven barns on it.
And seven?
Seven barns. So I...
What's the pneumatic tubing all about?
Oh, that's for dust collection.
Oh, okay.
Woodworking
tubing. I had a fantasy that you were maybe shooting messages to one another through pneumatic tubes.
Well,
I've always
speaking,
wanted
yeah.
that, by the way.
But so we
so you built you're
we
making
converted the biggest barn. You saw what it looked like before.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And
it's like a hangar.
It's so I've divided it in half. The front half is metalworking, and the back half is woodworking. And
is that your hobby?
Yeah,
yeah.
And I also have a library in my office.
Nice.
And also
you live in paradise.
All the that's what I tell my wife.
It's geek paradise.
So we can roll the
this is what our basement looked like until we moved.
We can roll the woodworking tools out
little
of that room
in our basement.
And create a classroom.
Oh, neat. So you do the classes there in the barn?
Classes.
Oh, that's neat.
Permaculture
that's great.
Classes. And,
you do vermiculture?
Permaculture.
Oh, vermiculture is worms.
Yeah, that's right.
What's permaculture?
Permaculture is, well, it's sustainable agriculture, really.
Neat.
And we've run some Cooper U classes there, too.
Fun. Look at the size of that. That is a nice barn.
So that's
barn.
What I do for fun. I call it the Shop Mahal. My son says it's the place for Shopaholics Anonymous.
You know the Taj Mahal is a tomb. Just pointing that out. Very, very nice. Alan Cooper.
So yeah, well, you should come out to the ranch.
I will come back. I will come back
and
come to the ranch and visit you and Sue and the
you
and
the chickens.
Shop Mahal. And
you can meet the Blessed Sisters of the Happy Breakfast.
It's nice to know people like you are in the world. It just makes me happy. We thank you all for joining us on a very kind of interesting triangulation from our brand new studio. Thank you for being here. We'll be back next week, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time. I think we'll be on time next week, 1800 UTC. Really, on time is kind of a flexible concept, since it's always on time if you download. And make sure you do. Get every episode of Triangulation. This is a show you never want to miss. You'll find it on our website, twit.tv/TRI. But you can also subscribe with your favorite podcatcher. And that way you'll get every episode the minute it arrives. Listen to it at your leisure. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.